In the first hour of the show today, we will look back to last year's presidential election contest in Florida. And our guest is Jake Tapper. He's Washington correspondent for the online magazine Salon. And he's authored a book that's just out recently that looks at what happened in Florida last year during the election and after. The title of his book is Down and Dirty, The Plot to Steal the Presidency. It is published by Little Brown and is in bookstores now if you want to look at it. We'll talk about the book this morning with Jake Tapper. And if you have questions, you certainly are welcome to call. All we ask of people who call in is that people just try to be brief. And we ask that so we can keep things moving along, get in as many people as possible. But anybody's welcome to call, and we'll try to get in as many folks as we can. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free line, and we'll pay for the call. Again, 800-222-WILL. And if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, use that local line. It's 333-WILL. Mr. Tapper, hello.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, of course.
A couple weeks ago, a study was published. This study was done jointly by MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and the California Institute of Technology, looking at the election last year. Mm-hmm. And what they concluded was something between 4 million and 6 million Americans either failed to cast votes or their votes were invalidated in the presidential election because of a number of things: faulty equipment, ballots that were mismarked, screw-ups at the polling places, problems with their registration, which leaves me to wonder whether, in fact, what we saw happen in Florida in terms of irregularities was any worse than any place else in this country.
It was worse than most places, not the worst in Illinois, I might add, but it certainly was worse than most places. But I mean, lumping in people who didn't vote with people who voted but had problems with the machines is not entirely fair, I don't think. But certainly, the larger point it seems like you're making that we've got some work to do as a nation when it comes to making sure that people know how to vote correctly. That is certainly well taken.
Yeah. Well, I guess indeed I was just thinking mostly about the fact that after the election, when all of these irregularities came to light in Florida, then news organizations, various places around the country, started looking at what had happened in their neighborhood and found that there are problems, similar kinds of problems, in many places. That makes you wonder about the outcome of any election.
Yeah, what happened in Florida, the harmonic convergence in Florida, was that, for instance, Illinois had, I think, more undervotes, overvotes, ballots that were scrapped, that were not read, than Florida did. But the margin of victory for Al Gore in Illinois exceeded the margin of victory of George Bush in Florida by many, many thousands. There were, for instance, 16,000 scrapped ballots in New Jersey, but that's a state that Al Gore won by hundreds of thousands of votes over George Bush. So it was the combination of the narrow margin of victory for George Bush, the incredibly narrow margin, with one of the largest amounts of unread ballots in the nation that made Florida unique this election. But your larger point is correct, of course, is that there are a lot of ballots all over the country that don't get read, and it's not fair to blame it all on Florida.
Yeah. Specifically, looking at Florida, we've had recounts and recounts. News organizations have gone back and looked at some, but not all of the ballots. Some of the places where there was questions about what the outcome was. Now, do you think anyone really knows what the correct vote tally in the state of Florida in the presidential election last year was?
No, and we never will. In fact, interestingly enough, just last week it was revealed, I think by the Chicago Tribune, boy, I'm giving all sorts of Illinois references today, I think by the Chicago Tribune that in Palm Beach County, they no longer even have the records of how the ballots were counted on the first night and then the subsequent counts. That software has been deleted or something. So no, there's really no record. All we have is the record of what took place on election night and then during the recounts, and then we're really left to guess and wonder as to what the real outcome would have been had either Bush or Gore, and this was the larger point in my book, had either one of them actually tried to find out who really won Florida.
Mm. And was there, well, it seemed that the Bush strategy was pretty clear as soon as they got what I guess would have been the first official recount, the one that was presided over and announced by Catherine Harris, that said they won. Then what they wanted to say was, okay, that's it. It's done. We won. And that they didn't really want to talk about doing much of anything in the way of recounts. The as far as the Gore side goes, the perception I think a lot of people had was, yeah, they were interested in a recount, but only if it would make sure that they won. So they didn't want to talk about doing something as radical and, you know, theoretically difficult as saying, okay, let's recount the entire state of Florida. At any point, did anybody seriously consider doing just that, saying, okay, let's start all over again and recount every vote in the state?
There were people who considered it, but it never got to the point where anybody who mattered was willing to make a step. You might remember Al Gore did twice offer a statewide recount, say that he would go along with one if Bush wanted one.
But he could easily have said that, knowing that probably the Bush people wouldn't.
Right, exactly, and of course he did. And of course, what he was pushing for at the time was a recount of the unread ballots in four Democratic-leaning counties, when in fact, you know, there were undervotes and overvotes all over the state. And if you're going to, it seems to me to be only fair that if you're going to call for, I flew into Florida on November 9th, early morning November 9th. I had been in Austin, Texas with then Governor Bush. I flew into Florida November 9th, reading in the paper that there were 175,000 unread ballots in Florida, and at that point Bush had a margin of victory that was under 1,000 and was shrinking by the hour. I was just amazed, and I, like you, and like I'm sure all your listeners, wanted to know, wow, well, who won those 175,000 votes? Because that's really the answer. That's really how you figure out what happened. Because you have all these complaints about, you know, butterfly ballots and people not knowing how to use the machines and the machines not counting properly. Well, let's do a recount, as happens all the time, all over the country. This was not the first recount, not only in American history, but this is not the first recount in Florida history. They take place all the time. In 1988, there was a statewide recount in Florida for a Senate race. Anyway, let's just do the recount, find out what happens. But the Gore people said, no, we're just going to try to get a recount in these four Democratic counties because we figure we can get enough votes to win just based on those four counties. And the Bush people said, no, we already won. And I thought that neither approach was fair or respectful to the voters of Florida.
There was a lot of confusion that night, aided and abetted by the networks and the way that they were reporting the results, which in part led to this the famous exchanges between Mr. Bush and Mr. Gore, where initially Gore called to concede and then called to unconcede.
Right.
And fortunately, they managed to make a decision before Mr. Gore actually went out in public and stood up and said, thanks for your support, but, you know, it's all over. Would it have been possible for there to have been less confusion on their part? I mean, is there any excuse for the campaigns to be so confused about what really was going on? Or would you not blame them and say, well, no, we can't blame them because everybody was confused about what was going on?
I mean, everybody was confused, but I don't know how many of your listeners have ever read the fantastic book by Malcolm Gladwell called The Tipping Point. And the point of the book, The Tipping Point, is that, you know, while we all tend to think of history and events as like weather fronts coming in, you know, these large uncontrollable masses of just fate changing events, in actuality, history is often shaped by one individual here, one individual there, responding to a certain and particular set of circumstances. And that happened all the time on election night. Michael Hooley, who was one of Gore's chief aides in charge of the field, getting the vote, getting out the vote, and that sort of thing. Michael Hooley was sitting there while, you know, Gore people were crying, thinking, you know, while Al Gore's daughters were crying in the hotel, 14 stories up, Michael Hooley was sitting there getting reports from his man on the ground in Tallahassee, Florida, saying that this thing wasn't over and that it, you know, that Gore should not concede. Michael Hooley, one of his assistants, a guy named Jeff Yarbrough, without even thinking, kind of like Radar O'Reilly and MASH, Yarbrough is like trying to reach somebody to track down Gore to make sure that he doesn't do anything stupid. Gore, meanwhile, is in the limo on his way to the war memorial to concede, and it's only through the modern communication methods like pagers and cell phones that that was stopped. If this election had happened, 20 years ago, 24 years ago, Gore would have conceded because they wouldn't have had the way to get to him in time.
Mm. Well, in light of the fact that there was this automatic recount required, if he had conceded, would that have made any difference? The election officials wouldn't have said, oh, well, Mr. Gore has conceded, that's it. There still would have had to have been a recount, wouldn't there?
Well, yes and no. You have to remember a couple things. One, you're right to say that Bush's margin of victory election night was less than one half of 1%. There was a state mandated recount. But most counties in Florida did not actually do that recount. Most of the counties in Florida, and remember, most counties in Florida were Bush counties. Gore won populous counties like Broward and Miami-Dade and Palm Beach, but he did not win in the same way that Bush won more counties across the country, but not more people. That's a way to look at Florida as well. And most counties did not do that state-mandated recount. Some of them just, Catherine Harris, who was a very, very partisan individual, and really the book defends Catherine Harris on a number of partisan Democrat charges against her, making fun of her makeup, rumors about her personal life, that sort of thing. But Catherine Harris, in terms of her being the elections official of the state, that is an outright shame that a woman so partisan and so compromised was put in charge of these decisions. She told these counties that it was okay for them not to do the recount if they didn't want to. If they wanted to just like double check that their software was working, that was enough. So your point, I guess what I'm saying is, who knows what would have happened, because Catherine Harris was so partisan and so unfair and bent over backwards so much for the George Bush side of things that even if Gore had conceded, you're saying, well, wouldn't the law have required
recount anyway?
Who knows what she would have done?
Yeah.
Who knows what she would have done? We're finding out stuff today that in the papers in Florida she offered an extension. It gets really complicated. And I don't want to bore your listeners, but she'd offered an extension for the counties that wanted some extra time to do their recounts. And she said she would, make an announcement based on their requests for an extension. But it came out today that she'd already written her rejection letter before those requests for an extension had even been filed.
Hmm. Our guest this morning in this part of Focus 580, Jake Tapper. He is Washington correspondent for Salon, the online magazine, and is the author of a recent book that looks at what happened last year in Florida in the presidential election. The title of his book is Down and Dirty, The Plot to Steal the Presidency, published by Little Brown. We have a couple of callers here ready to go and would be very happy to talk with other folks. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. First caller here is in Belgium, and that's line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
During a show Mr. Inge had last week, he had a listener from San Francisco that pointed out that one of Bush's ancestors was particularly interested with the Nationalist Socialist Party in Germany in the early portions of the Second World War. And they were finally told to stop it. And then we know George the First, his father, was involved with the CIA and many of these nefarious things down in Central America. It seems to me, if you want to look at the history of this family, they're not at all opposed to doing things that might influence things for them, just like this Catherine Harris, and who knows what else, his brother in a pivotal state. It seems to me it goes without saying that there was some kind of hanky-panky someplace.
Well, Mr. Tapper, you want to respond to that?
Well, I think, I'm not in the business of saying what I think is possible. I'm in the business of, you know, recording what did happen or what, you know, to the best of my ability to sift out the wheat from the chaff, what, you know, what is history and report that sort of thing. I mean, the caller has a point in that George Bush the First was director of the Central Intelligence Agency, but does that mean I think that he was using spies to get, you know, his son the presidency? No. Does it mean that I think that the Bush family, like a lot of political families, Democrats too, are, you know, are ruthless and did what they needed to do to win in Florida? I do. And I think it's possible that, you know, there's more that went on than meets the eye, but, you know, it's very tough to prove these things. That's one of the reasons why there are so few political corruption cases that are actually proven. Because it's usually, you know, for a guy like Rostenkowski, you know, embezzling stamps. It's never for any major upheaval because those things, people don't leave fingerprints. So I share the caller's skepticism, but I don't know that I share his conviction that that anything untoward actually happened that involved the CIA.
Oh, I didn't mean that the CIA was involved. I'm just saying influences were peddled.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, this is a ruthless family, just you know, but you know, the Gore people were ruthless, too.
Oh, yes, Gore has no shining armor to stand in. Thank you very much.
No,
that was one of Gore's problems in this election, in the election and in the recount, is that if he had said during the recount, you know what, we have 175,000 Floridians whose ballots were not counted, let's just count them all, let the chips fall where they may. You know, get Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter in here, put them in charge of it all, and let's just do this. But no, he and his team decided to, you know, manipulate Florida law to pursue vote recounting in four Democratic counties. And two of those counties were picked just because they were Democratic counties where there were votes that maybe they thought they could win. The other two were chosen because of voting irregularities, Volusia County and Palm Beach County. But Broward and Miami-Dade were only chosen because they were Democratic counties. That's something that Gore officials will tell you right off the bat. Hmm.
And now, I don't want to put too fine a point on this, but for people who are listening, I just want to make sure that they understand that this is not you're not making a partisan statement here. That you seem to be saying that both sides in this were willing to do whatever to win.
Yeah, whatever this side of the law of
right.
the line of law.
Right.
Yes, both. It seemed to me that both sides were that it was a war between thieves to a degree. That a statesman was needed, and you know there were some individuals out there, a few of them even Republican, who were saying, you know what? It seems to me we need to do a statewide recount and then just decide what happens. Chuck Hagel, senator from Nebraska, conservative Republican, supported Bush. He said, we need to do a statewide recount. I don't understand either side, what either side is arguing here. But people like that are few and far between in American politics. Usually they follow the party line.
Another caller here. Next is Rantoul. It's line number one. Hello.
Hi. I just had a factual question about something the guest said earlier about the four Democratic counties that the Democrats wanted counted and suggesting that was unfair. And I just wanted to clarify if I was misunderstanding. My understanding had been that the Florida law only allowed for a party to challenge the results in three or four counties, and so that was really all that they could do, that they couldn't by law challenge the results statewide, and they could only pick a certain number of counties to challenge it in.
That's not right. They could have asked for a statewide count. They could have asked for a county-by-county count. There is nothing limiting you to three or four counties. Now, that would be a very daunting task bureaucratically to try to get to send a Democratic lawyer to each one of Florida's 67 counties and ask for a recount. But there was nothing in the law that said they couldn't do it. And also you have to remember there were two phases of challenging an election. There was the protest phase in which you could pick out counties, and then there was the contest phase, really where anything could happen. But the Gore people, in order to get to the contest phase, which is when, you know, you get before a judge and you say, this is what we want, let's order a statewide recount or whatever, in order to get to that phase, you have to, the election has to be certified. And the Gore people did not want the election certified because they thought, and they were right, that public relations-wise, that would be bad for Gore, because people would be like, well, Bush has been certified the president, let's just get this over with. So they tried to avoid that at all costs. But unfortunately, what that meant is, and they found an ally in the Florida Supreme Court, which offered them an extension on the certification. But what that meant was that when it came time for the contest phase, which is really when the whole statewide recount could have taken place, if not before, you can do it in either protest or contest, probably easier to do it in the contest phase. In that phase, they had far less time because they'd got the extension on phase one. It gets complicated, but the point is that all of this was unprecedented on a presidential level, and the Gore team could have made the argument, let's do a statewide recount, let's do what the Republican Senator Chuck Hagel says, et cetera, and could have taken it from there. In fact, there were people on the Gore team who thought that the plan was that they were just going to try to run up a margin of victory in the protest phase in these four Democratic counties, and then in the contest phase, whoever was behind, whether it was Bush or Gore, would then say, okay, well, now let's do a statewide recount no matter what. And these Gore lieutenants were very upset when, not only by the fact that Gore was still behind when it came time for the contest phase, but that when it came, that what they had been told, that now they were going to do a statewide, was not true. That when it came time for the contest phase, the Gore senior staffers decided, we're just going to try to get 51 votes here and 100 votes there and 300 votes there, and that will add up to a victory, as opposed to going for the statewide that they had been under the impression they were going to try for all along.
Right. I just a quick follow-up, and then I'll hang up and listen. I'm curious, based on the amount of research you've done, whether you think that your book or other books out on the topic now are definitive, or whether you think it's possible that in years to come, more information will come to light that will cast the process in a different light. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, well, you think there's more yet to be learned?
I would be low, as a journalist, I'd be loath to say that mine is the definitive version, you know, especially because, as is the tendency in news and in history, so much tends to come out 10, 20, 30 years down the road, especially after a few players have passed on, et cetera. But that said, I haven't seen very much in any of the subsequent books that makes me think, like, I wish I had pursued other avenues. I mean, as of right now, I'm pretty happy. I reserve the right to retract that in the future.
All right, we'll go on here, and let's go to Champagne next, line number two. Hello.
Hi, I've been reading your book. It's really fascinating. About the statewide recount, I thought I read in one of the early chapters that they had considered doing a statewide recount at first, but they didn't have the resources to battle all the Republican canvassing boards.
Yeah, that's right. That's what they thought early on. They thought that they didn't have the resources to do it. But there's also the argument that they didn't think they had to because they weren't pursuing a course of what is best for Florida, or even listening to their recount experts. This was one of the things that I thought was most interesting. First of all, thanks for reading the book. I appreciate it, and thanks for your nice words. But there are people who make a living as recount lawyers, and Gore had a couple of them with him on the ground in Florida, a guy named Jack Young and a guy named Chris Souter. These were recount experts.
Are these the guys that wrote the recount primer?
Exactly. They wrote the recount primer. And one of the lessons in the recount primer, and this is in the postscript of the book, but it won't be ruining it for you. But one of the lessons they learned is that there was a recount in the early 80s in Indiana. It was just a house race, but it was called Indiana's Bloody Eighth because it was a very, very heated debate in the U.S. Congress. And the Democrats did not adhere to the lessons learned from Indiana's Bloody Eighth, from the lessons that the Republicans, the mistakes that the Republicans made in that the Republicans in that race in Indiana pursued a method of recounting the ballots that was on its face allowable by law, but when you take a step back, it seemed unfair. And so the U.S. Congress was able to come in and wipe the slate clean and say, no, we need to do things differently because this is unfair. You're excluding some ballots here, you're including other ballots there, and that's just not fair. And it's funny because that's almost exactly what happened to the Democrats on a national level when it came to Florida, because they pursued what was legal in Florida, but was also the stage so that the U.S. Supreme Court could come in, and maybe they were inclined to do so, but of course they were inclined to do so, come in and say this is not being conducted in a fair way. And the recount experts, Jack Young and Chris Souter, were pushing, indeed, as you say, for a statewide recount right off the bat because they thought that was the best method, that was the most fair method, and also, frankly, the best likelihood they had of winning. If you're trying to win, if you're trying to hit 50 home runs, you don't step up to the bat and ask for 50 pitches. You ask for 5,000, and with each new ballot, whether it was from a Republican district or not, they were presented with the opportunity for Gore to rack up more votes.
I've got one more question.
Yes.
Could you address the differences between Texas law and Florida law on hand recounts? It seems to me that Bush got away with one there.
Oh, you got that right. That was one of the most disingenuous things that frustrated me as a journalist on the ground to no end. Not only to hear the Bush people lying about this over and over. Well, let me clarify. The Texas law and the Florida law are both equally vague. They both leave it up to the subjectivity of people who are reviewing the ballots, the intent of the voter, as determined by whoever's reviewing the ballots. This is a law that then Governor Bush signed in 1997. Equally vague, an equally vague law as the Florida law, but in favor of hand recounts, as happens all over the country, hand recounts. You know, Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle, his first race for House only came, you know, he was only sworn in officially after a year and a half because there was this lengthy recount in the state of South Dakota in his district. I mean, it happens all the time. His number two, the deputy majority leader, Harry Reid, went through a tough recount battle in his last reelection in Nevada. Very, very common. It's just that, you know, as a country, Americans don't tend to pay that much attention to it. The media tends not to pay that much attention to it. We saw why in Florida, it's kind of boring. But that said, Bush signed a recount law, hand recount law, and then when basically the same law was up in Florida was being discussed, the Bushies acted as if the very notion of hand recounts was corrupt, was silly. How can people be counted on to judge these things fairly and impartially? And you're right. I mean, he got away with it because I don't know why, but it was exactly what he had signed into law in Texas.
We're a little bit past the midpoint here. We got some other callers, and I'd also like to introduce again our guest. We're speaking with Jake Tapper. He's Washington correspondent for the online magazine Salon and is the author of a book about what happened in Florida last year in the presidential race. The title of his book is Down and Dirty, The Plot to Steal the Presidency. It's published by Little Brown. Questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. When the campaigns realized there was going to be this recount, they knew that they were going to have people there on the ground representing their interests. And to lead the two efforts, they selected these two former secretaries of state. For the Democrats, it was Warren Christopher. For the Republicans, it was James Baker. How did that choice of each of these men to lead the two efforts sort of determine the character and the strategy that the two sides pursued?
Well, quite a bit. James Baker, who Bush came to call General Baker by the end because he was so impressed with him. James Baker, whether or not you agree or approve of what he did in Florida, he did it really well. This is a guy who understood the world. He's a lawyer. and a ruthless politico, and also has something of a gift for PR, although I found him rather distasteful when I was in Florida. And then you have Warren Christopher, who was, you know, barely present, only 6 or 7 years older than James Baker, but a lot more frail, a lot less vigorous, had a more demure, more of a statesman type. He had obligations back home. His wife's best friend had just passed away. His daughter was sick, and you know, the disparity between those two generals really ended up manifesting itself in a far better shop operated out of the Bush camp.
We have other callers here. Let's get back to them. Southeastern Illinois next. It's line number 4. Hello.
Yes, you made a statement earlier, Mr. Ames, about the man from Salon Magazine not making a partisan remark. He's been surprisingly objective, if you take the title of the book, Down and Dirty, The Plot to Steal the Presidency, you're about as partisan as you can get there.
On which side?
Well, are you assuming that both of them were playing down and dirty and both were plotting to steal the presidency?
Yeah, and I do explain that in the both in the foreword and the postscript of the book, that the plot is, you can read into, you can assign that plot to whichever side you want.
In other words, then, in either case, they would have been crooks that were in the White House, so it really, you know, I mean, it's just a matter of a partisan judgment as to which group of crooks you want, you know. I mean,
that's right.
But what I was going to say was two hypotheticals. Let us, as a hypothetical, assume that Mr. Gore was as concerned about the health of the body politic in this country as was Mr. Nixon when quite possibly the election was stolen from him by Kennedy in Illinois and Texas particularly. And he said, no, you know, it's going to tear up the nation if we by try and contest that and just let it go. Gore had been a statesman, had the concern for the country that Mr. Nixon had, I think he would have made a similar statement. And also, what would be the hypothetical, I wonder if Mr. Gore and those who have been rallying around him since the election, rallying around the fact that he should have won, who would be the junior senator from the state of Missouri? You know, the Democrats ran a dead man in the state of Missouri, and the dead man was elected. I mean, it's an old political tradition to vote tombstones, but when you start electing tombstones, I think that's going a little bit too far, but
well, remember,
Ashcroft didn't contest it. He just let it go at that, and that's how he wound up as Attorney General. He wouldn't even be Attorney General I just don't think you can be a valid candidate once you're dead. I mean, they could have run a write-in vote for his widow, but of course they wouldn't have won a write-in vote because people don't write-in vote.
I think what had happened. Oh, I'm sorry. Were you not done yet? Sorry.
I kind of jump in because I wanted to give you a chance to respond, and then I hope the caller would forgive me because we're getting into our last 10 minutes, and I have three other people holding. I'd
okay,
like to try to get them too.
I'll make it quick. The what happened in Missouri, I'll not touch just because that's not relevant to the book. Although I certainly understand what the caller was saying. In terms of Nixon, Nixon does make a number of appearances in the book. Interestingly, one of Bush's attorneys, a guy named Fred Bartlett, was, when he had just gotten out of law school in 1960, sent to Texas as a young associate attorney to investigate voter fraud on behalf of the Republican Party. And this is one of the biggest myths of in history, that Nixon was somehow this great statesman. Certainly it can be argued that he was a greater statesman in this respect than Al Gore was, but Nixon didn't formally concede defeat in 1960 until 3 days after the election, and he did so by his own admission with thoughts that the recount would take up to half a year, and with consideration of his future political viability foremost in his mind. Nixon gets into this in his memoirs. But the Republican Party did begin investigating allegations about Illinois, about voter fraud in Illinois and Texas. And there were all sorts of investigations. The RNC chairman at the time, a guy named Senator Thurston Morton of Kentucky, flew to Chicago, announced the formation of the National Recount and Fair Elections Committee, et cetera. A lot of stuff was going on, you know, behind closed doors and secretly, and not so much in front of the cameras as it was. But Nixon was not did not concede defeat immediately, and in fact, the Republican Party was considering challenging the Kennedy presidency well past the election. But I do get into that in the book.
We have about 10 minutes left. Our guest, again, Jake Tapper from Salon, and we're talking about last year's presidential contest in Florida, and we'll try to get in as many callers as we can in the time that remains. We'll go on next to somebody in Champaign. This is line one. Hello.
Hello. Getting back to the recount, I would like to ask, Mr. Baker was quite adamant in Florida about not continuing the recount many times over. Yet, I understand that some western states, I believe it was Washington State was one of them, had a recount, and it was sanctioned by the Bush camp. About the only media outlet I found this in was the New York Times. And I'm wondering if the media learned some lessons from this election and in future will be more alert. It seems some of the information that was not reported or sloughed over had a lot more impact than they led us to believe. Another was, of course, the people running into one of the places where recounts were being held, and you heard varying reports of violence or no violence or whatever. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Tapper.
Well, there were pursued possible recounts in other states by Republicans, and I mean there was a huge disconnect in between what the Bush people said about Florida and what they thought about doing in other states in terms of recounts in New Mexico being the most glaring example. But in the end, there were not these recounts. They kept the options open, but in the end, they did not actually pursue them. But I do, I think there are a lot of lessons for the media to learn from the Florida mess, and I do not share. I don't think that those lessons will be learned, except for possibly calling a state before all the polls in the state have closed. That's probably the only one, in my opinion, that the media will change its behavior on.
That was one thing I did want to ask you about, because certainly there were a lot of complaints about the way that media makes and broadcasts projections about results, and afterwards lots of mea culpas and the media saying, yeah, we know we got a problem, we'll look at this. But one wonders if in the next time around whether anything really is going to be any different.
Well, I think that states will. I think that the media outlets will be more circumspect when it comes to calling a. This was a charge that the Bush people make that is a very valid charge. The fact that networks called the state of Florida for Gore before the polls in the western part of the state, which is a much more Republican part of the state, before they were closed, is a very offensive occurrence by the media. It's probably counterbalanced by the fact that, the decision to call Florida for Bush in the end, the first network to do so was Fox News Channel, and the guy at the decision desk was Bush's first cousin, a guy named John Ellis. But that was not a good moment for the media.
Okay, let's go to Urbana. This is line number two. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Thanks for the show.
Sure.
Two quick questions. Is it true, as I've heard, that the first recount that was requested in Florida was by the Republican Party in Seminole County on the 9th, And what can you say briefly about the, for lack of a better phrase, the felonistic voter roll that was purchased by the state of Florida from Texas? Thank you.
Two issues there. Seminole County, I don't know of, there was in several counties something of a recount, not a full hand recount, but there's something of a reexamination of the ballots in several counties where Bush won that were not, it was not covered, did not receive the same kind of media attention, and certainly being that they were Bush counties where Bush ended up picking up votes in a lot of times, these were areas that the Bush people did not complain about. A lot of them are detailed in my book. The felonistic voting rolls is a huge issue, one that gets to, you know, some of the more egregious violations of, well, I don't want to say violations of the law, but certainly violations of the pact between a public official and the voters. What had happened was in the state of Florida in 1998 began buying, hiring a private company to keep lists of felons who did not have the right to vote, and so that they could be gleaned from the voting rolls. Because in 1997, in a mayor's race in Florida, a lot of felons voted, and the whole election was thrown out. But the voting rolls were by this private company, a company that did have a lot of Republican ties, were not perfect, to say the least, and a lot of individuals who had the right to vote were denied the right to vote. And canvassing board and elections officials complained about this to Catherine Harris, the Secretary of State, and Clay Roberts, the Division of Elections Chief, and they didn't really do anything about it. Now, where it gets into conspiracy theories is in the simple fact that, for a whole bunch of reasons we don't have to go into now, obviously felons are disproportionately minorities are represented in prisons. And so if you are looking to take away the voting rights of somebody with a stereotypically African-American name, like, you know, I don't even know, Ronnie Jones, Ronnie Jackson, or from somebody with a stereotypically Latino name, Miguel Dominguez or something like that, and you are disenfranchising somebody with that name, you're taking away his right to vote, but you're taking away the right to vote of a different Ronnie Jones, Ronnie Jackson, or Miguel Dominguez. You are therefore disproportionately taking away the right to vote of minorities who you know, have every right to vote. And the fact that Catherine Harris and her Division of Elections Chief were so unconcerned by this, even though the complaints have been going on for years, is seen as, at the very least, a sort of benign racism. It's hard to make the charge without proof that these people did this on purpose, but it's certainly no great leap to say that if they had been disproportionately disenfranchising people with the name Charles Winthrop, that maybe they would not have been a little bit more active on fixing those voter rolls.
All right. Let's go to another Urbana person. This is line three. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
This wasn't actually what I was calling about, but as it came up, the Chicago Nixon supposed fraud, there are almost certainly everyone who's knowledgeable about it agrees there was some fraud in Chicago.
Absolutely.
But counterbalancing that is the probability there was even more fraud downstate in the Republican areas, so that if Nixon had called a recount, he probably would have lost votes in the aggregate. And that had a lot to do with their decision not to request the recounts.
You're
familiar with that, aren't you?
No, I would not argue with that. There certainly were allegations of voter fraud. In fact, if you get into histories of Illinois in November, Illinois voting in November 1960, it's almost becomes like a strange game of tennis where people downstate holding their election returns, people in Chicago holding theirs. Downstate they release some, Chicago they release some of theirs, et cetera. You know, without question, the Chicago machine was crooked, as the Pulitzer Prize-winning investigation by the Chicago Tribune revealed, in the early 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. I mean, there was fraud, more than enough fraud to go around on both sides.
Yes, Illinois has a regrettable history. But what I really wanted to ask about was the things not directly in the election, but charges of detours put up, making it difficult to get to polling places, people having apparently registered but not be appearing on the rolls. Do these charges actually hold up, or?
Well, again, it's tough to. I mean, some of them do, yes. But again, not in the way that not in any sort of easily identifiable or prosecutorial way. You can say there was a Florida Highway Patrol checkpoint that was put up a mile from a two-thirds black precinct outside Tallahassee in Leon County. And that checkpoint did not go by the regular rules and regulations. They did not get did not get clearance for it before they did it. But can you prove that they did that to, like, stop blacks from voting when, in fact, for the previous month, they'd been setting up checkpoints all over the state because the state was short of, Florida Highway Patrol was short of funds, and it saved them gas money to just run checkpoints every now and then. You can't prove it. And, it is true, and it is suspicious, but suspicious isn't enough.
It could have been freelancing, but done so with the knowledge that there'd probably be no retribution for it. Would that be a fair statement?
It's possible.
I mean, that doesn't take conspiracy. It doesn't take complicity, even. But it can create a really bad situation in a state that once was much worse.
It's possible, but I have to say, you know, the Gore people did look at all sorts of allegations mm-hmm. of civil rights, and the most offensive thing they found, a guy named Henry Latimer, who was a very successful Fort Lauderdale attorney, an African-American, who the Gore team put in charge of this sort of thing, and the most offensive thing he found, yes, there were anecdotes here and there about all sorts of malfeasance or charges of, you know, these two white people were let in to vote, the last minute, and a whole line of black people weren't, et cetera. But the most offensive thing were all the individuals in the African-American precincts whose ballots were not counted because they voted wrong or the machine screwed up some way.
I'm going to jump in here, and I'm really sorry to have to say we're at the end, but we are, and we have another caller that we can't take, but we've at the end of the time. We could keep going, I'm sure, but for people who are interested in reading about this, the story is covered in great depth and detail in the book that we've mentioned, so you can look for that. It's titled Down and Dirty, The Plot to Steal the Presidency. It's published by Little Brown by Jake Tapper. He is Washington correspondent for Salon, the online magazine. Mr. Tapper, I want to say thanks very much for talking with us today.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you very much.